delighted to be with Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of the wonderful Defenders of Wildlife. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. Mr. Schlickhuysen, I have to say, it puzzles me in that same vein as Bill was saying, why didn't we pick Romulus and Remus and the wolf mothering the beginning of the Roman Empire? Why not that image? Because that the nurturing, the bonding, the mother puppy relationship, that's as strong in the story of the wolf as Little Red Riding Hood.
I can't tell you why we didn't pick it. Certainly, it would have worked out better for the wolf if we had, and actually for us,
and for humans. Seems to me that we overlook what we lose by being killers of wolves.
We have had at least 8 years, and arguably a lot longer, of denial of reality. Science went by the board, research, evidence, all of those kinds of things, as a matter of essentially federal policy, and it infected large parts of the nation. The evidence, if we can get people to look at evidence, is simply overwhelming that having these, what Paul characterizes, keystone creatures, the big predators, charismatic megafauna, in another context, that those people are essential in a healthy environment.
You mean the wolf people?
I mean wolves, but also not just wolves. We don't have to, I mean, that is characterism. This is ecology. This is a rich, complex system, and it requires its primary predators. Other than humans.
Oh, it does. It does. I mean, there's almost all species, and I'm going to say almost all, have a very worthwhile function that they perform. I mean, there's a reason we talk about the web of life. We all are interconnected in this, and there is a role that all these species play, and especially predator species and keystone species. Keystone species, and they can be small in the big prairie grasslands of the West. The prairie dog is a keystone species. It's kind of nature's Big Mac. Feeds a lot of other things.
And what exactly does that mean? A keystone species.
A keystone species was, I think you started with the idea that
what did I say?
It's kind of what holds the ecosystem together, if you will, and keeps it viable, that keeps it healthy. It performs these functions that make the ecosystem biologically more rich than it would be. You mentioned the idea of the wolf and being a keystone species, and I said a little while ago that when they brought the wolf back, that's when they really were aware of this. And I'll abbreviate the story, but just to give you a sense of it, I think most people will agree that Yellowstone Park was overpopulated with elk before. There is some debate about it, but most people, I think that park was overpopulated with elk. Well, when it's overpopulated with elk, then they browse, these basically being browsing animals, they browse and they take the vegetation down. Well, with the vegetation down, that provides for a lot of other wildlife aren't there. So when they brought the wolf back, the elk numbers dropped somewhat, but more important than the elk numbers dropping, when the wolves came back, they forced the elk to move around, because they were preying on the elk, and so they wouldn't spend all of their time in the valleys. And since they didn't spend all of their time in the valleys, then the vegetation there, and especially the willows and the aspen, had a chance to grow again. And as the willow and the aspen grew, and they shaded the river was cooler, it ended up supporting more fish. Because you have willow and aspen, the beavers came back because they had something to eat and something to build dams with. And the birds had something more to nest in, so the birds came back. And the beavers build the dams, create the wetlands. Then the ducks come back. All of this life is back. It is much more biologically rich than it was before, and it's all providing food for each other in this process. And it is a more dynamic, more exciting, and biologically rich ecosystem than it was before. And it was, in this case, it was the top predator with their actions kind of at the top of the food chain, kind of cascading down through the ecosystem and all these other species, benefiting them. So that's an example of a keystone species kind of at the top of the predator chain. I already mentioned the prairie dog is a keystone species because so many things, birds of prey, for example, black-footed ferrets, feed off of the prairie dog, and so you get them at both ends.
It doesn't have to be in a park for this.
No, it's In fact, it's at work everywhere, and because humans are there now developing all this, and kind of, if we're not careful, the ecosystem isn't healthy because we're taking this species out or that species out of it, and the ecosystem changes then because we're, you know, and if you happen to get one of the keystone species in the process, then it really changes in a negative way, and negative meaning that it is much more biologically rich than it was before. And if the ecosystems aren't as healthy as they were before, since we all live our rich lives off of the ecosystem services that are provided, then they're not going to do as good a job decomposing waste. They're not going to do as good a job cleaning our water so that we can drink it, regulating our air, controlling erosion, pollinating our plants. We see what are happening now with the bee population, and yet like one third of our food crops are pollinated. So you have these kinds of problems besides the aesthetic enjoyment we get from it, the medicines that sometimes come from nature. I think something like one third of all the pharmaceuticals that we sell out there come pretty directly from nature, and just the emotional enjoyment and the sporting recreational activities we get from it. It provides for us in a very rich way. And so when the rate of a species extinction exceeds the rate of speciation, and so, and since it has, kind of since the start of the Industrial Revolution, in fact, we have a much less rich nature, biologically rich nature, than we have before, and our opportunities of how we make our livelihoods off of that, even if you don't care for, you know, whether we have an obligation to other life forms, I happen to think we do, maybe, even if you're looking at it from this selfish perspective of humanity, looking at it, we are impoverishing, if you will, future generations by causing a collapse to some degree, a loss of rich biological diversity. That's been going on, well, probably pretty much since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and it's accelerating now because of global warming.
I don't want to go away. I want to say one other thing about, you mentioned the elk. I'm fairly confident that more people have been injured by elk than by wolves.
Oh, yes. But it is, you ask me, you know, ask
exactly.
Me, it is a very irrational thing. I mean, our organization, Defenders of Wildlife, is the organization that compensates ranchers in the West because they lose livestock to grizzlies and to wolves. And we recognize that there is a loss that they're experiencing there, and so we try to help make them whole in the process. But people lose sight of this. If a wolf takes down a calf someplace, it makes the story in the state newspaper and the local newspaper, and I can't remember what the factor is, but I'll bet you they lose 50 to 100 times as many calves or you know, livestock of one form or another to domestic dogs every year than they do to wolves. But it is the emotional factor that plays in when wolves are the predators.
It was, I think, our friends in the Montana Nature Conservancy who've done a lot with trying to get things back as they were, who introduced us to the notion.
Before the arrival of Europeans.
Right. Introduced the idea that they and their thinking, and I'm sure this is characteristic of you and lots of other people, have started building humans into the ecosystem, because mm-hmm. the humans are a part of the ecosystem, you mm-hmm. simply. And there was a tendency early on to try to deal with a natural non-human environment as a separate entity from humans. And it seems to me, you know, a large part of the challenge, not only with respect to wolves, but for everything you're dealing with, that human piece, getting people, helping people to see the world around them in a different way, is just dead center of what you have
to
do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you do that?
Well, you try. I mean, we try. You do it with education. I mean, we were talking about the wolves in particular a little while ago. You try to debunk the myths. We support various organizations that have kind of ambassador wolves that take them around to classrooms and to events. So we happen to have an event in Brooklyn. In fact, just next week, when there will be an ambassador wolf there. And we will you know, be letting someone see a wolf, you know, up close and personal. I used to bring them to my child's school when he was going to grade school. So we try to do the best we can, but you can't do it. There's not enough money in the world for nonprofit charitable organizations to accomplish this. You really need the media's attention. And the media has got a lot of things to write about, and they don't always pick the subjects that you think are important.
And yet, if we're not paying attention to things that the Defenders of Wildlife pays attention to, you don't want me to support what you do just because it's nice. You want me to be looking at the life cycle, the life forms that make it possible to sustain life on Earth. We're going to talk a little later about global warming, because it's, oddly enough, a direct flip from wolves to global warming, which may not be obvious. And if we are looking strictly at the selfish, as you put it, our lives depend on this stuff.
Oh, yes.
It's like we depend on ants.
Oh, yes.
Well, let's slick it up. Let's call it utilitarian.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, because
this is very utilitarian. If you yes. take out the natural world, oxygen is the first thing that
yes.
oxygen and water
we've got a lot at stake in all this, and I think probably lots of folks have done it, but the eminent evolutionary biologist at Harvard, Edward O. Wilson, has pointed out that it's very unfortunate for the planet and for all of the species that the species that happened to end up being in control, more or less, is one that doesn't have a very long-range view in the way we plan and undertake things. We do not plan in the long term. If we did, we would recognize that what we're doing in terms of the biodiversity of the planet is very important. He had a phrase that I often mention. Now, one day I got to go back and look at it to make sure I get it exactly right. But he says that the loss of biodiversity is the folly for which future generations will be least forgiving when they look back on at us, because that is the infrastructure, the natural infrastructure that we make our livelihood off of, and future generations must make their livelihood off of. It's the most basic.
E.O. Wilson also says that we are a very young species, and we'd better hurry up and grow up.
Yes.
Well. Roger Schlickhuysen is our guest. We'll be back in just a moment. Please be with us when we return.